Good evening, good morning. Thank you for tuning in to the best in overnight talk radio. Coast to Coast AM is on the air. I'm your host for the evening. My name is Dave Schrader. This evening we'll be spending some time with Von Brashler, Confessions of a Reluctant Ghost Hunter, a cautionary tale of encounters with malevolent entities and other disembodied spirits. Von Brashler, a former faculty member at the Omega Institute for Holistic Studies, has led workshops throughout the United States and the United Kingdom. A lifetime member of the Theosophical Society, he is the author of several books, including Seven Secrets of Time Travel. We'll be talking with Von Brashler and opening phone lines to you this evening. It's your time to shine. You can call in, share your stories and thoughts, and you can have some questions for our guest as well a little bit later. I'll also be hosting tomorrow night on Coast to Coast AM. My special guests for the entire show will be William J. Burns and Joel Martin. We're going to be talking about time travel. We'll also talk about parallel universes, alternate realities, the deja vu phenomena, time slips, and some really kind of groundbreaking, interesting thoughts on our lifespan, how it may be affecting the false memory situation. So we're going to discuss all that tomorrow night on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we've got a couple of interesting stories in the news that we're going to cover, including the fact that our planet may not be the only one that was seeded by the same meteors that struck our planet. Our planet may have also helped to evolve other planets and life around the solar system. We'll talk a little bit about that. We'll talk about a mystery that's been solved right here on our planet, that may also give us answers to what occurred earlier this year on Mars with the Mars rover. And we'll also talk about a very strange story that comes out of India regarding witches and sorcery. That's all coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. Good evening and welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host for the evening. My name is Dave Schrader. I appreciate you joining me on the beginning of a long Labor Day weekend. I'll be with you again tomorrow night. As I said, we'll be talking about time travel tomorrow night. Have a couple of news stories I want to cover before we get to our guest, Von Brashler, for the evening. This I thought was intriguing. Earlier this year, we were talking about the Mars rover and the fact that when it powered back up, there appeared to be a rock in one of the photographs, a rock that just appeared out of nowhere. You know, there's been many different theories on what happened, speculation that maybe it had become part of the rover at one point and it eventually had fallen off. Some believe aliens had thrown it at the Mars rover at one point. Well, this tied into something that we've talked about throughout last few years on both Coast to Coast and on my show, Darkness Radio, the mystery of Death Valley's sailing stones, which is a very interesting phenomenon. If you haven't seen this, large rocks have been known to move about. It's a secluded corner of Death Valley National Park where rocks known as sailing stones have actually been known to move across level surfaces completely unaided by gravity. And we know the mysterious shifts occur because the rocks, some weighing as much as 700 pounds, leave behind these long trails in the soil. But no one's been able to figure out exactly what's causing these stones to move. Until now, that is. Over the years, scientists and laypeople have offered all sorts of theories to explain the sailing stones. Some said that the stones were blown by strong winds or pulled by magnetic fields. And actually, others blamed pranksters or even aliens. Not satisfied with those explanations, a group of researchers and volunteers back in 2011, they attached GPS units to 15 rocks and placed them in Racetrack Playa, the dry lake formation where the moving rocks are found. And then they sat back to see what would happen. One of the researchers, John Hopkins University physicist Dr. Ralph Lorenz, called this project the most boring experiment ever. 2 years passed. Then two of Lorenz's collaborators, a Dr. Richard Norris, a paleobiology professor at the Scripps Institute of Oceanography, and Jim Norris, an engineer at Interwolf, the company that developed the GPS trackers, paid a visit to the area only to discover that it was flooded with water. It was then that they witnessed the sailing phenomena firsthand. Science sometimes has an element of luck, Richard Norris said in a written statement released by Scripps. We expected to wait 5 or 10 years without anything moving, but only 2 years into the project, we just happened to be there at the right time to see it happen in person. The researchers determined that the rocks move only under a set of very specific conditions. First, there has to be water by the playa at a level just deep enough for the bases of the rocks to be surrounded by a thin window pane of ice. If these panes are big enough, even a light wind is enough to move the ice-ringed rocks, according to the scientists. So if you could picture when you've got that glass of iced tea sitting on the table and it begins to slide across the table on its own as though it's being pushed or moved, is that ice on the bottom is melting and perhaps a breeze is blowing by and causing that slow, gentle move. That's a lot like what they're trying to explain is going on with these rocks and how they're moving across the desert. Once in motion, actually, the rocks, the move itself fits and starts, sometimes making these abrupt changes in direction as the wind shifts, according to the researchers. The last suspected movement was all the way back in 2006. So rocks may move only about 1/1,000,000th of the time, Lorenz said in the statement. There's also evidence that the frequency of rock movement, which seems to require cold nights to form ice, may have declined since the 1970s due to climate change. So this could also reveal and help us understand how the rock on Mars moved. Could there have been a thin layer of ice that moved underneath one of these rocks that was simply outside of the projected image that the Mars rover was taking photographs of? And a thin layer at nighttime could have caused us to help move it and with the winds and things that were going on. That could have been the answer. So science may have provided an answer to what happened here on Earth and on Mars with the rover. Another interesting story that crossed us this week. Some scientists believe alien life was actually transported to Earth on a comet, which is a theory known as panspermia. But if alien life can travel between planets, the opposite may also be true, and parts of Earth could be seeding life elsewhere in the solar system. The theory has now gained traction over the past few years, with scientists claiming that the asteroid that wiped out the dinosaurs took Earth life to Mars and as far as the moons of Jupiter. So in a paper last year, Rachel Worth, a PhD candidate at Penn State University, said that it's likely that life from Earth was already brought to other planets. Ms. Worth's team first looked at the number of rocks bigger than 9.8 feet that were thrown out into space from Earth by major impacts, according to a report by Maddie Stone in Motherboard. The size of the rock would shield microbes from the sun's radiation over a journey across the solar system. Using computer simulations, the team then mapped the fate of these rocks. And while many would not have survived this journey, they're saying that they believe thousands of the rocks hit Mars, and about 6 rocks made it as far as Europa, a moon of Jupiter with an icy crust. Could that be enough to spur new life? Now, at the end of the day, it's not the numbers themselves that are matter, but it's the order of magnitude, Ms. Worth told Motherboard. If the numbers were much lower than 1, we'd assume this event is unlikely to have occurred since the origin of life on Earth. But 1 to 10 impacts over the last several billion years tell us we can't rule out the possibility of life from Earth seeding an outer solar system moon. The theory has led some scientists to imagine a future in which humans could colonize space by sending DNA to distant planets and printing a new civilization. In a talk at the Smithsonian Magazine's The Future is Here Festival in Washington, D.C. in May, NASA engineer Adam Seltzer spoke about the future of space exploration. And aside from reiterating the importance that we continue manned exploration, he spoke of a lesser-known method of space exploration, sending the human genome to far-flung planets. The idea was first dreamed up by Harvard biologists Dr. Gary Ruvkin and Dr. George Church, as reported in a Harvard Medical School release. How these bacteria would grow into humans is still up for debate. They could simply be left to evolve, as life did on Earth, seeding another planet with our own organisms. I mean, that's an interesting thought. We could become the gods of another planet by seeding and sending our own DNA out there. Many scientists are of the belief that we will one day be able to create multicellular life, and it stands to reason that this could include an organism as complex as human. Interesting story. Here's one just off the charts bizarre. This story comes off from India, and a very bizarre story. A coven of witches chopped off a man's arms and burned him alive when he asked them for help treating his sick 10-year-old son, police say. Mr. Chopra's wife and son told police they watched helplessly as he was stabbed repeatedly and hacked with axes before the witches set him on fire with kerosene-soaked rags. They were laughing and dancing around his body to music while he screamed in agony. In the end, there was just a pile of ashes left, said a police spokesman in Mandla, Madhya Pradesh, the closest city to where the ritual slaying happened. Mr. Chopra had sought out the local witch doctor, known only as Pravati, for treatment for his 10-year-old son, said the police. But as soon as the family reached her commune, Pravati branded Mr. Chopra as a rival sorcerer and ordered her disciples to kill him. His wife, Shushama, later told police it was sickening. They surrounded him and took turns to stab with tridents and hack at him with an axe. They cut off his hands because they said that was where his power was. My husband told them he had no powers, no witchcraft, but they wouldn't listen. The more he screamed, the more they sang, and the more they laughed. Then to make sure his power was gone forever, they said they had to burn him. This was in front of our son, who was terrified. Pravati and her followers allowed Shushama and her son to leave, but vowed to curse them if they told anyone. The pair ignored the threats and traveled all night to the nearest police station, where they reported the killing. Very disturbing story. Coming out of India with this. Police actually said the witch and six of her followers are now in custody awaiting trial for murder. They confiscated literature on witchcraft as well as axes and tridents from the scene and have also recovered some of the ashes for forensic tests, said a police spokesman. The killing comes amid growing hysteria over witchcraft in India. Earlier this month, a 35-year-old woman in Bihar was dragged from her home, beaten, and forced to eat horrific things after she was blamed for casting a spell which caused the death of a neighbor. Just weeks before that, 10 people were arrested in Odisha after the torture of a 60-year-old woman who was left in critical condition after she was blamed for the death of an 18-year-old boy. Medical records show he, in fact, just died of malaria. Strange stories from all around the world. Right now, we're going to go to one of my favorite guests. We've had him on Darkness Radio. I know that he's been a contributor here on Coast to Coast AM as well. Von Brashler, a former faculty member at Omega Institute for Holistic Studies, again, has led workshops throughout the United States and the United Kingdom. A lifetime member of the Theosophical Society, he's an author of several books, including Seven Secrets of Time Travel. His new book, Confessions of a Reluctant Ghost Hunter, a cautionary tale of encounters with malevolent entities and other disembodied spirits. Welcome back to Coast, Von Brashler.
Thank you, Dave. Good to be on the show.
It's always a pleasure to speak with you, Von, and I appreciate you coming on a little late and hanging out with us this evening. Interesting book, and I mean, certainly you're taking a different stance on a lot of things that, you know, have become very popular in pop culture with the ghost hunting and paranormal investigating. Now, you've had psychic sensitivities and the availability to see spirits. Has that been something that's always been a part of your life?
Yes. Well, even when I was young, growing up in the Seattle area, I would see ghosts, or I would either see them or sense them or hear them. And so I always had some kind of a sensitivity, but I think a lot of people do. There's just different levels. You can put 10 people in a room and maybe half of them will sense something and the other half will sense nothing. I was always in the group that could kind of pick up on something, and I'd often see them. And I had lots of ghostly encounters, but they were not dangerous, and they were just kind of confusing to me, and I frankly never knew what to say to them.
Well, when you see the ghost, Von, I mean, actually physically see them, are you seeing them with your eyes or are you seeing them in your mind's eye?
Yeah, that's a good question, because I think there's some confusion. Yeah, it's a different kind of seeing. There's two ways that psychic people like myself would normally see a ghost. One is you shift your eyes a little to the left, And then you could see things, you know. And, you know, we call that the crack in the worlds, you know, between the cracks in the worlds. The other way would be in your mind's eye, that you actually visualize it very clearly in your mind's eye. This is very often the way people see auras as well. That's the way I see them. More often now, I hear them, I'm clairaudient, so that happens most often. And some people will go into a room, you know, and they will feel a cold chill, very typical with a ghostly spirit of some sort, or they will sense kind of an emptiness or an oddness to the room.
Now, when you're talking about being able to hear spirits, are you just picking up like a radio? Are you listening and you can hear full messages and conversations? Are they talking to you, or are they talking to each
other? Sometimes you would be very clear in your head as though you were hearing it aloud. So clear that you would swear that it was aloud, and it might have been aloud, out loud, that is to say physical sound waves. Then again, it usually is just a sound you hear in your head.
And with the sounds that you're picking up on, again, do you hear as though you're listening in on a phone line to somebody else's conversations that are going on?
That's very often it. And ghosts, you know, are very often ritualistic. They're like stuck in time. They're stuck in time and space, in fact. And they're like locked in this place. They're probably locked in a room, endlessly living out the same scene at the same, maybe even the same time of day. Making the same movements or the same sounds, and we're just kind of witnessing this thing over and over and over like a never-ending play that keeps acted out at certain times of the day.
Now, a lot of people refer to that as a residual haunting, something that you're able to just tap into and hear these motions. When you're doing that and you start to hear this as a clear audience, do you start to try to focus to see if, you know, either by looking kind of off to the left or so, do you try to open up so that you can also see what it is that he's speaking?
Well, that was my training, and it does work. If you're very still and you get everyone else out of the room, and you just sit very quietly and you center and you get very still inside yourself and kind of, you know, basically you meditate, you get all the outside sounds stilled and all the inside thoughts ended, and you're just completely, as you would say, a clear channel, and then you can very more distinctly hear or perhaps see what you need to. You can actually communicate with them. And that was what I was eventually trained to do.
You know, one thing I'm curious about, when you're tuning in, and I know that I do this when I go to investigations myself. If I begin to hear things, I'll close down my other senses. I'll shut my eyes and try to focus if I'm hearing things to try, A, to find the direction that it's coming from. But, B, I do find that often when I close my eyes, it'll help me to, I don't know if it's, you know, the old adage that you take away some of the senses, that adds to the others. But do you find that when you start to hear things, will you close down the other senses to try to get a clearer message of what's coming through?
Yeah, that's very often the case. When you close your eyes, you can more clearly focus beyond the physical. I mean, basically, you're now getting into a state of conscious awareness, leaving your physical senses behind, which are sometimes useful and sometimes not. And then sometimes I've gotten to where I actually just give up on that and I just start, you know, shouting out loud, you know. You know, come to me, you know, show yourself. Sometimes you have to be rather forceful. But yes, it's usually better just to get still within yourself, as you described. That works best.
How do you differentiate for yourself between a real experience and a vividly imaginative experience? I mean, we as humans have capability of imagining great things. And every one of us knows that we've been in that position where somebody starts to talk about spiders or lice, right? And all of a sudden your hair starts to itch or you start feeling the creepy crawlies under your skin. If people are telling you it's a haunted location, how do you know you're not just, your imagination isn't taking over?
That's true. But here's the funny thing. You know, you're actually, probably if someone says, spiders, you know, there are spiders everywhere. And then you'll start to visualize the spiders and you can actually creatively visualize the spiders. And I think if you continue that line of thinking, you could actually creatively visualize the spiders and there would be a spider, you know. So you kind of create your own reality through this imaginative process. And a lot of people just are highly imaginative. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, the lady that trained me to ghost hunt, or as she called it, de-ghosting houses, she said, you know, a lot of times people think they have a ghost. They really don't know. That's why we go in, you know, because they think there's something odd and they make up some story. And it's very often not what they think it is.
Confessions of a Reluctant Ghost Hunter, a cautionary tale of encounters with malevolent entities and other disembodied spirits. Von Brashler, our guest, for about the next hour and a half. We'll open up phone lines in an hour so you can call in if you have any stories or questions for our guest. Stay tuned. The best in overnight talk radio continues. You're listening to Coast AM. Our guest this evening, Von Brashler, despite early recognition of his own psychic sensitivities and ability to see spirits, Von Brashler did not seek to become a ghost hunter. He entered on this path through a chance encounter with a professional paranormal investigator. After training with her, he returned to Oregon, where he began exercising ghosts for friends and acquaintances. And as he reveals in the pages of his new book, Confessions of a Reluctant Ghost Hunter, a cautionary tale of encounters with malevolent entities and other disembodied spirits, he quickly stumbled upon forces far beyond his level of experience. We'll find out more about his story and hear some of the chilling encounters he's had right after this. Von Brashler, our guest this evening on Coast to Coast AM. We'll open up phone lines next hour. So if you have questions for our guest or some of your own accounts you'd like to relate to him, you can give a call and be a part of the show with us. And then the last 2 hours of the show, open phone lines. We'd love to hear from you. Let's get back to the show now. Von Brashler, our guest for the evening, his book, Confession of a Reluctant Ghost Hunter. We've got links up to Von's website and to his book. You can go find that over at coasttocoastam.com. Von, let's start talking about your training. I mean, you said that you went into this reluctantly. It wasn't until you had this chance encounter with a professional ghost investigator that this opened up for you. As somebody who could see ghosts and experience them through your life, was it more of a irritation than a blessing?
Yeah, I think that's true. I just kind of ignored them, or sometimes I'd shot up at them, go away, or I thought that was curious and I wonder who they are. But frankly, I never knew what to say to them. And so I was a journalist in the Pacific Northwest, and one of the papers I worked for briefly was in Anacortes, Washington, in the San Juans. And we put out a summer magazine for all the islands. So I got to go to the islands. And I went to one island where there was a psychic author named Lewis Gettner. And I became quite, you know, a fan of his and a student of his. And I would come, I would visit with him when he had time. He was very, very giving for those he'd met along the way, would travel to the island. And one day, however, he was not able to come out to see me, and he sent his secretary named Helen. And she comes out and she says, Lewis can't see you today. And he suggested that I might talk to you. I'm his secretary. My name is Helen. And I said, well, what do you do? He said, well, I work with him, you know, with the books and here at the inn, and take, you know, I'm just kind of his all-around secretary. But I also have another job outside of here. I de-ghost houses. I said, you do what? He said, I de-ghost houses. He said, on request, I go into people's homes or buildings, and I contact, communicate with ghosts that I might find there, and I try to communicate with them and reason with them to move on, which is really quite natural, she said, really quite natural. They really have no trouble doing that. They just need a little encouragement. They'll be reluctant or stubborn or confused. Maybe they have unresolved issues. They don't want to move on. But I just try to reason with them, and it's really quite easy. She said, would this interest you? And I said, yes, I think so. I think so. And I said, tell me more. She spoke with me, you know, that whole day. And I was there the next day with friends in the paper. And so I met with her again early in the morning. And I work all night to prepare my list of things I must know. And she said, put the list away. There's very little you need to know. She tells me about going in and clearing the house and assuring the people that you you can find the ghost, and that it will be easy, and that I can do this. And she takes me through the things I might need. She said, if there's a reluctant ghost, there are certain tools you might bring with you. And she told me what those are. She said, carry them with you in a little bag, just in case you have a reluctant one, and you need to, salt the house or stake the house or, chase them out. She said, because it's a terrible thing for a house to be haunted. It's very bad for the people who are bothered by the haunting, and it's very bad for the ghost who's stuck there in time, and you do everyone a good service. And I said, are there any problems in this? And she said, well, sometimes people will make their own problems. They will have kind of lost their emotions, and they'll have outbursts of anger and hate and jealousy and rage and all these thoughts, which are normally directed and projected at people as thought forms, then become just kind of loose all over the house. And eventually they'll form kind of a cloud, and the cloud in time takes the shape of the creators, the people. And it'll be a hulking figure. Originally, you'll find it in a corner just sitting there. And as you feed it your negative emotions, it will begin to ramble through the house like a spirit of itself. But it's a shadowy figure that was created by people. And in those cases, you simply tell people to stop feeding it, and it should shrink. And if you can't shrink it down, well, then you might just have to encourage them to leave. But she says that's a very rare thing. Usually you just go into a house and you'll find someone seated on a sofa, and it will be some old lady or little old man, maybe with a hat, coat, maybe a cane and a handbag. And they look like they're ready to go, like they're going to catch a bus or something. But they're a little reluctant. They're a little nervous. They're just sitting there. And you just have to kind of sit with them and assure them that it's okay to move on. So she said, is this something you'd like to do? And I said, well, I don't really know. I've always seen ghosts. And she said, tell me about the ghost you've seen. And I told her many stories, most of which I have in the book. And she said, well, that's sad. She says, you encounter these spirits, but you don't know what to do with them. I said, really, no. She said, so this might be a good thing for you to know. And I said, but Helen, I don't think I really want to do this. I don't want to, become a ghost hunter. She said, well, there might come a time in your life when you have friends or neighbors who really need someone who can help. Now you know the basics. And I never really thought much about that until later on.
Vaughn, did she ever relate to you? Was there ever cases where people would make claims that they were being bothered by ghosts, that she would go there and there was nothing there?
Yes. She said, sometimes people are just confused. It's not what they think. It's something entirely different. You can't find any kind of a spirit there. You would find negative emotions floating around the house, as she said, but mostly you would find someone who's just passed on. It might be a dog or a cat or something like that. But sometimes you'd find absolutely nothing, and they're just imagining it, And she said, it's best just to clear people out so you can clearly communicate one-to-one with it. There's no confusing all these thoughts flying around the room.
Well, when you go in there and there's nobody there, I mean, how do you bring peace to people in that case then that are obviously creating it or imagining it? But they still, to them, it's very real, Vaughn. Do you tell them, I'm sorry, there's nothing here, you're imagining it?
Yeah, she would sit down there, and she'd say, sometimes you think, you're projecting something that's just really not there. I'm quite certain I can't pick up on anything here. And she would be honest. She'd say, I might be wrong, she said, but I've spent a lot of time here and I pick up nothing. Now, I will add this, now that I've done it on my own. There are times when ghosts just simply choose when they're going to appear, or make their presence known. So they can kind of disguise themselves. They'll hide. I mean, that happened to me at a Portland church where I tried to get an old ghost out of an old church. And it just kind of like moved around. It didn't want to be found. It just wouldn't be found. It was always one room ahead of me. And it didn't want to be confronted, didn't want to communicate with me. It seemed just happy just to rumble around. But it didn't seem to be in any way a dangerous thing in the building. It just bothered people from time to time. They learned to live with it. And that's often the case.
Well, and I know that you've run up against some dark things and some...
Yeah.
Yeah, I hesitate to call them demonics, but if you go into a house where somebody's really feeling pestered and bothered, wouldn't they make themselves scarce when you guys show up because they know you're coming?
That's what I found, and I tell, I guess, three stories that happened to be at Mount Hood in Oregon when I moved and worked on a community newspaper up there. I knew friends. I guess the worst was the woman herbalist, the Native American herbalist who had the mobile home, the trailer in the woods up near Rhododendron in Mount Hood. And it was a trailer that the owner could not rent or sell. No one seemed interested in living there. There were names and dates carved in a tree outside the mobile home, which looked to be like dog names. There was a some kind of a spirit in the house that manifested itself in different ways to different people. So it was kind of shifty. It was kind of disguised. And it would appear to the girl, the young girl who drew the pictures of the herbs for her mother, the herbalist, who led these herbal walks through the forest. It would appear to the little girl as a little girl with golden curls. And it would kind of appear to her kind of like an imaginary playmate, or so her mother and stepfather thought, but it would sit there on the bed with her, according to the girl, and play and look over her shoulder, which she drew in the book. And later on, the thing actually drew in the book, which really freaked us out. And then it would appear differently to her mother and stepfather in the other part of the mobile home. In their bedroom, they would be strangled at night, and they would awaken in the middle of the night with the sensation they were being strangled, although there were no physical signs of strangling. But there was a sensation that they were being strangled, and they'd run out of the house. And luckily, there were two of them, so one would make a sound, and the other one would shake them awake, and they'd run outside. So they asked me to go inside and investigate, and it was very, very hard to corner that spirit, but it was trapped in the trailer, and so I eventually did confront it, but it was really not a little girl with curls, or was it? I mean, it first appeared to me as a dark, brooding creature, what I would picture to be a forest gnome, and it was quite hideous looking, and had dark eyes and a brooding sneer to it. And then when I found it, I was so shocked, I shouted out to it aloud, you're no little girl with golden curls. And then it quickly turned into a little girl with golden curls. So, then I spent a lot of time trying to get it out of the trailer. And I kind of did get it out of the trailer. But then the trailer spontaneously caught fire within a few days. And their dog was, their dog, which had never been tied up in its life, was burned under the trailer, tied up with a chain. And it was a mystery because the fire investigators, the fire marshal and his crew, could not find any cause to the fire. There was no candles or no stove problem. They investigated it rather thoroughly. So, there is a very malevolent side to some of this. And I think that people really need to realize, too, that not every haunting involves the deceased person. You know, there are other spirits out there that are really much more deadly and dangerous than we might want to imagine.
All right. Well,
probably people
define that.
Spirits that never were earthly beings, never had a physical life, and are not part of this physical world.
Where did they come from then, Vaughn?
Gosh, I wish I knew. I'll take that back. You know, I'd rather not know.
Well, when you confront them, I mean, do they give any information on themselves? You would think they were very, that powerful.
No, very, very, very guarded, very guarded. And in the case of the trailer spirit, I got it out of the trailer eventually. And then it got in the car with me, and when I'm trying to drive down the road in my little Triumph sports car, it's strangling me as I'm driving. It's causing the car the lights go out, and eventually I can't start the car. And then I can start the car only when I turn around and bring it back. Well, I don't necessarily put it back in the building. I salt the building, and I stake the building, but then it still is very angry. And it burns the trailer down, apparently, and kills the dog and pretty much ruins their lives. Very, very secretive, deceptive creatures. There are a lot of things in the spirit world that are not simply deceased people. It's not all Aunt Ruth out there. You know, somebody's maiden aunt or somebody from another century that just, you know, living in what used to be their home and does not want to leave. There are spirits that are quite dangerous. So walking into a haunted house can be a rather dangerous encounter. And I think people need to realize that, because there is quite a sensation going on right now, a glorification of the fun of ghost hunting. There are people are stalking ghosts and houses, and they're trying to record them and bringing in equipment and hunting them from room to room. And I just wonder what their intents are. I mean, unlike my friend Helen, are they really trying to help deceased people gently move on to the next part of their life? Or are they badgering these poor things?
Well, let's talk about these creatures, these beings that you come up against. We've only got a few minutes left in this segment, Vaughn, but do you ever find, I mean, we talk about the malevolent spirits, the ones that maybe never walked the earth in a human form.
Yeah.
Can some spirits that have been here a long time, do they get stronger in time, or do they begin to fade like a memory in a shadow, a shade? Do they go away that way?
Well, here's what I've come to understand is that we're dealing with the shell of, in the case of deceased people, we're dealing with the shell of that person. Their soul has moved on. The higher aspects of their spirit has moved on. There's aspects of their emotional astral body that are here. There's parts of their lower ego, as far as their personality, some dim recollection of being here, which does not want to leave. Now, these are not the higher life forms. When you talk about someone's, you know, eternal life form, that's probably moved on. But there are people who have become fragmented. I'm sure your listeners have heard of shamanic soul retrieval. I think it's kind of a misnomer, you know. But there are aspects of our spirit body which become fragmented from time to time through emotional upheaval or discord. And a lot of times there are kind of like residual aspects of persons that glom onto us.
Well, let's continue with that when we return. Vaughn Brashler, our guest, Confessions of a Reluctant Ghost Hunter, continues on Coast to Coast AM.